I'm ready. Let's do it. You've got questions. We've got answers.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Some of you might be thinking, I want to ask a question, but I think it's kind of a dumb question. Well, if it's a legitimate question you have and you think I can help you answer it, give us a call. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you today. 866-348-7884. As we do every Friday, you've got questions, we've got answers. And all next week, as I'm scheduled to be in India, leaving Sunday afternoon and coming back the following Sunday afternoon, we've got special broadcasts prepared for you. If there's something of tremendous importance happening in India that I need to communicate with you, I'll break into a broadcast in the middle of the night from India to let you know in the States and wherever else you are listening and watching. But we have pre-recorded some terrific broadcasts every day, really with the goal of edifying you, blessing you, helping you, encouraging you, strengthening you, stretching you. So be sure to tune in every day next week. If you miss any broadcast, they're all archived on our website, AskDrBrown.org, on our Facebook page, AskDrBrown, on our YouTube channel, AskDrBrown, readily available for you. And you can always subscribe to our podcasts at thelineoffire.org. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to the phones, and we start in New York. Aiden, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've benefited greatly from your ministry, so thank you very much. My question is regard to the kind of things that are said in Revelation and in James that where it said that Jesus will come soon, or it's at hand, or do not seal up this document and all that stuff. And James too, it says that Jesus coming is at hand. Like, how should we view that in light of? I guess my question is, how should we view that in light of the fact that it's been like 2,000 years since, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so of course this came up in a debate that I did a couple weeks back now with a full preterist. We'll have the debate available for folks to view pretty soon. But that was his biggest argument, that Jesus says, I'm coming soon, I'm coming very soon. James 4, as you mentioned, the judge is knocking at the door. Hebrews 10, he's going to come, and he won't delay. So how do we understand that in light of the fact that he's not yet returned? Well, my debating opponent insisted that Jesus has already come, not only so, that we're already living in the new heaven and earth, and that mourning and death and sighing have passed away. So I mean, it was an easily refuted argument, and almost amazing that some of those points could be made. However, there's a valid question about these verses. So there are several responses. One is that soon could be speaking very clearly in terms of a time frame. Soon or quickly could be speaking of a manner, of a sense of imminence, of a sense of being at the door. And in that sense, every generation has lived with anticipation that they could see the coming of the Lord, just as we live. That the way God designed it, we don't know in history when God finally breaks in and the end comes. If you give a time frame of saying it's going to be 3,000 years, then there's going to be total complacency. People fall asleep. If you say it's going to be in 3 months, then you're not going to get realistic planning and thinking. Kind of normal life will stop. So basically, the biblical method of communication, and we have some instances in the Old Testament, for example, Haggai 2, that God's going to shake everything and it's just a little while, and that's 500 years before the time of Jesus. So you have language like that it's coming quickly, he's at the door, and he could have come, theoretically, at any time in history. Only he knows when all prophecies have been fulfilled and when everything is in place. So that's part of it, the manner, the imminence, the sense of being at the door, and that I've lived with it my entire believing life, just as believers live with it in the first century. That's one answer. A second answer is that there are absolutely things in the book of Revelation that had total relevance to the believers that heard them. And that's part of apocalyptic language, this visionary language that kind of pictures everything in terms of end time cataclysmic events, that much of it has absolute relevance to the shaking in which they lived. So that's another aspect in which it's true. And then there is the day of the Lord, meaning the final time of his coming and ruling and reigning and transforming the universe and new heavens and new earth. And 2 Peter 3 reminds us that you shouldn't say, well, he delays his coming because with the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years, but the day of the Lord will come. On the other hand, there are many, many days of the Lord in history. So in the Old Testament, the prophets often spoke of the day of the Lord. That meant a time of God coming in power and judgment. So that happened in the lifetimes of the prophets, as well as centuries later, as well as things we're still waiting for. So in that sense, the Lord has come in power and judgment and action and saved and delivered and judged many times through history, but we're still waiting for the coming that will be in flaming fire, taking down vengeance on those that don't know God, at which point we will be physically resurrected or physically transformed to be with him forever. That's the way I understand those passages and that particular language. On several different levels, that's how I understand it.
Okay, thank you. That helps a lot. Thank you very much.
Awesome. You are very welcome and so glad we've been a blessing to you, sir. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Seagrove, North Carolina. Todd, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. My question is having to do with the different translations of the Bible when it concerns the book of Psalms. I know in some translations they don't have the psalm headings at all. Some have them, and others have them as well, but some are in different places. And I'm just curious to find out what the criteria is or has been as far as the psalm mm-hmm. headings about
yep.
you know, where they should be and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. So the psalm headings should be there right at the beginning of the psalm. In the Hebrew versification, they are the first verse. And in the Greek versification, they are just a heading followed by the first verse. That's why you'll see the numbering in the psalms can often be different from, say, a Jewish translation and a Christian translation. And some of the psalms, like Psalm 1, Psalm 2, for example, don't have a heading. Some have a very specific heading, like Psalm 51, that gives you the background to the psalm of David being confronted by Nathan the prophet after his sin with Bathsheba, or Psalm 90, which is a psalm of Moses, the man of God. There's tradition that says Psalm 91 was also a psalm of Moses because it's not attributed, but they should be there. So just looking, for example, at one translation here, of course, there's nothing for Psalm 1 and 2. As I said, there's no heading. But then Psalm 3:1, a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. And now that remains part of verse 1, Lord, how my foes increase. If you look in Hebrew versification, verse 1 is the heading, and then verse 2 will be that opening verse. But they should be there. If a translation leaves it out, it is leaving out something that was part of the original biblical text, and there's no justification for it. Can you think of a translation that does that leaves the psalm headings out, Todd?
Well, I'll give you an example. I know that when Alexander Scorby re-recorded the King James Version of the Bible in the 70s, he was given a version, I can't talk today for some reason, a version of the King James Version that did not have the psalm headings in it at all.
Here's the deal. The psalm headings are often considered secondary, meaning that this is often understood that the psalm heading was added by someone else later on, all right? But it's still part of our biblical texts as we have them. So even if the psalm heading was added later on, giving instructions about the psalm, how it's to be sung, the melody it's to be sung to, or here's the background to the psalm, or read this psalm against this background, whatever the case may be, even if it was not written, say, by David in writing the psalm himself, someone else added it in later, It's still part of the biblical text that's been passed down to us and therefore should be part of it. Now, again, it may have just been a choice in the reading or in the editing that this was left out for production for some reason, but they should be there. No, they absolutely should be there. The only question is going to be, number one, whether it's read as a separate verse or not, or number two, is it written by the person that wrote the psalm or someone else wrote it later? Either way, it is part of the Bible. Hey, thank you for asking, Todd. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Stephen in Orlando, Florida. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. My question is about some Bible translations, specifically the Septuagint. So I heard from a pretty well-known counter-missionary. His statement was that the Septuagint was originally the first five books, which I'm familiar with, but then the rest of the prophets weren't translated until after Christ, which is why it can't be an authoritative.
Yeah, that's complete. Yeah, complete and utter nonsense and fiction. In terms of Septuagintal scholars, no, nobody would even consider that for a split second. So here's the deal. Here's what you do have. You do have Jewish tradition. So ancient Jewish tradition, it's the traditions we have are all well after the time of Jesus, saying, and it reflects what's written in the letter of Aristeus, that there were 70 different or 72 different scholars, Jewish scholars, who all independently were put in you know their booths basically to translate, and they all translated the five books of Moses, the Torah, and when they came out, it was all identical. It was perfectly inspired. It was identical. So that's valid, the five books of Moses in the Septuagint, but the rest is not valid, etc. So first, that's complete myth, and the translation is not a supernaturally inspired translation. And Septuagintal scholars will tell you, you can see there were different hands involved with the translation of the Torah. It was not just one person or all these people with the same. But it gets the name Septuagint from this tradition of the 70. But the Septuagint translation dates back. The earliest parts could be as early as 300 B.C. and the latest parts maybe about 150 B.C. But the Septuagint was well in place as the Greek translation of the Jewish scriptures well before the time of Jesus and the apostles. And the reason it's quoted by them is because it was the Greek translation of the Jewish world. Afterwards, other translations were composed as well, and some were composed to come against the Christian usage of the Septuagint. All right, stay there. I want to give you one more bit of information.
Fire we want, for fire we
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends, you've got questions, we've got answers. 866-34-TRUTH. So, Stephen in Orlando, one quick word. If you'll type in Jewish Encyclopedia, one word or two, and then type in it on your search engine, then type in Bible translations. All right, you will get an article from, 1906, Jewish Encyclopedia, reflecting scholarly views at that time, but by top Jewish scholars, highly respected scholars, and others. And if you'll go there, you'll read about Septuagint, you'll read about the different speculation, and even then saying that the probability is that all of it was translated before the time of the New Testament, etc., and that all the debate about the earlier parts of it and so on and so forth. Anyway, this will tell you about the Jewish traditions as well as give you a good scholarly perspective. But if you look at any serious Septuagintal scholarly work, look at the work of Emmanuel Tov, certainly one of the world's foremost Septuagintal scholars and is an Israeli professor. Emmanuel Tov, look at his intro to the Septuagint. You will not find the views of this counter-missionary confirmed quite the contrary. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. One quick thing, then we go right back to the phones. This past Tuesday is known as Giving Tuesday. I don't know when the tradition began, but we, like many others, sent out an email encouraging you to stand with the ministry work that we do. I want to thank all of you who wrote in, who sent in donations online and through other means. I want to thank you so much for your help. And I want to encourage you that you can give if you missed Giving Tuesday. I leave Sunday for India, trip number 26 to India. And even though the trip itself is paid for, there's time on both sides of the trip and the whole time I'm there that we're unable to bring in funds for our ministry. Others have paid for us to go over there, but we just go over there to serve and bless. And we don't use our India trips as some big fundraising mechanism and things like that, because we're going there to bless our friends there and then come back and do the work we're doing here. So if you could stand with us, a one-time gift of any size. Remember, it's tax deductible, and you may be thinking of that at the end of the year. Thank you in advance. Go to AskDrBrown.org. Click on donate. AskDrBrown.org. Click on donate. Oh, and I looked up, and we have a phone line open. So if you want to call, this is a great time to call. Let's go to Joel in California. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you.
First, just want to say you've blessed me so much with your ministry. I listen to you every day, and I just really appreciate it. I've watched all your debates, and I'm reading many of your books as well, and I just really appreciate you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Joel. Appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. I got two questions to squeeze in here real quick. One is, I was doing a study on wine in biblical times, specifically the time of Jesus. And I came across somebody writing, and they said a Jewish person was only permitted to drink 4 cups during Passover, 2 at a wedding, and 1 at circumcision. And they also said women and children were not allowed to drink wine and were given grape juice. And I was wondering if you could speak to if there was any truth to that. And then the second question was, did Paul contradict Peter's rules to the Gentiles that he gave in Acts 15? Did Paul kind of contradict that in Romans 14, Colossians 2, and then 1 Corinthians 10? I was wondering if you could speak to that as well.
Yeah, so let's answer the second one first. Jesus as well, in the book of Revelation, rebukes those that were encouraging eating food sacrificed to idols. So was Paul blatantly going against that? No, I don't see that as a possibility at all. Rather, this is what I understand. Paul was saying, because the world in which people lived, you really didn't know when you went to the meat market what was sacrificed to an idol and what wasn't. In other words, you got the local temple, and sacrifices are brought, so the priests would eat some of the meat and things like that, and it'd be dedicated to an idol. Some of it would be burned on an altar. But then you had other parts of the sacrifice that were just sold to the meat market. And when you're going to, you go to someone's home to eat, you have no idea whether that food was sacrificed to an idol or not. Just like, for example, if you go to the grocery store, you don't know if the people selling the meat are part of the mafia and are using profits for illegal purposes. You have no idea, right? Or if the farm was dedicated to some Hindu deity, you know, where the cows are raised. Or you have no idea of that. So the people would have no idea, but it could mess with you. Like, well, can I do this? Is it all right? What if I go to the home of someone? I know the person's an idol worshiper, but they want me to eat there. And Paul's saying, "Is the food is just food, and in and of itself is meaningless. So don't worry about it. But if, in fact, you are told this is for an idol or from an idol, then you don't do it. Even though you know yourself it's not defiling, for that person's sake, you don't. So separation was called for where you did know what the case was. So Paul says, as to the eating of food offered to idols, 1 Corinthians 8, we know that an idol has no real existence and that there's no God but one. And then he goes on glorifying the Father and Son. Then he says, however, verse 7, not all possess this knowledge, but some through former association with idols eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. So his point is, some people are eating the food and thinking, oh, did I defile myself? Shouldn't I have done that? And they don't know. So he's saying, if you do know it's offered to an idol, even though food itself is just food, Jesus also made that clear. It goes, in your mouth can't defile you. It's what comes out of your heart that can defile you. For conscience sake, don't do it, especially for the sake of the idolater, the idol worshiper. Don't do it. You separate yourself from that. So he's not teaching anything contrary, and he's certainly not encouraging it. The encouraging of it that's rebuked in the book of Revelation is certainly a participation in idolatry and eating food sacrificed to idols in a way that was participating in idolatrous rites or cults. And that's what's really being condemned there.
Could you say that Peter was more giving that rebuke, that if you're, you know, consciously partaking in sacrificing to idols and then eating that meat, then that has to stop? Or was he simply saying kind of what Paul was saying, if you know that this has been sacrificed to an idol, then go ahead and don't eat it?
No, I don't. Okay. Initially in the book of Acts, when things are laid out in Acts, the 15th chapter, there are certain fundamental things that these Gentile believers are asked to separate themselves from that would have been very much a part of their lives and that involve participation in idolatrous rites and participation in things that would break table fellowship with a Jew. So because that was laid out, now the question comes up, well, I'm not sure if it's offered to an idol or not. What should I do? That's what Paul is addressing. So what Paul is addressing is presupposing that Acts 15, that council, that teaching was out there and was known. So as for your source about wine drinking in the New Testament, what did you have a reference for it? Did it claim to be from an ancient Jewish source?
I lost the reference. I didn't keep it, because when I read it, I thought, I don't see this as true. And then I kept researching for a while, and I couldn't come across anything that supported it. And then I thought, I'm going to ask Dr. Brown about that.
Refer you to a traditional Jewish source. So just jot this down, Chabad, that's Chabad.org. This is a respected traditional Jewish source, Chabad, Chabad.org. And then look for, what is Judaism's take on alcohol consumption? What is Judaism's take on alcohol consumption? Now, certainly, there were various laws and traditions. For example, there were 4 cups of wine that people would drink on Passover, all right? But to this day, for example, during the Festival of Purim, traditional Jews will drink some...
Sorry.
Well, that's okay. We'll drink sometimes to excess, you know, just part of the party and celebration. And there are other instances in Deuteronomy where, for example, when you're bringing your tithe, let's say you've been accumulating grain, so you turn it into money, and now you bring it to Jerusalem, and before you donate it, you take a portion, and you can feast, and you can drink wine or a strong drink at that particular time. So, and as it notes here, we use wine for Kiddush and Havdalah on Shabbat, so beginning and end of Sabbath, and Jewish holidays, and many, many mitzvot, commandments, are accompanied by a cup of wine. So there may have been some tradition there that was being reflected and was taken as if that was the whole story. So again, if you go to this traditional Jewish website, Chabad, Chabad.org, and then look for what is Judaism's take on alcohol consumption, you will find that. All right. Appreciate the call, and so glad that we've been a blessing to you in life and ministry. All right. Tell you what, I do not have time to take another question before the break. So as soon as we come back, let's see who's next. Danny, then Brian, then Sean, then Josh. And, you know, it's interesting based on subject matter that Fridays we tend to get, if I'm correct, many, 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 many more calls from men than women. And other days, based on subject matter, more calls from women than men. But everybody is welcome to call, including those who differ with me. And let me just say this one quick word. To all of you seeking to do the work of ministry and help others, maybe you're pastoring, maybe you've got a house group, maybe there's just other work you're doing, don't wear yourself out trying to please critics. Take constructive criticism as a gift from God that's going to help you and sharpen you and strengthen you. But the negative critics, the destructive critics, they're not going to support you. They're not going to help you. And you'll never satisfy them until you compromise the very things that the Lord has given you to do. So pray for them, bless them, and focus on the work. But if you are a critic and you want to call, you're more than welcome. I would love to talk with you face to face as much as we can by phone. All right, we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Shake the nation, change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us and being part of the broadcast. This is Michael Brown. You've got questions. We've got answers. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. And we go instantly to the phones, starting in Canada with Danny. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
How you doing, Michael?
Very well. Thank you.
Good, good. Just want to say real quick, before I get to my question, as Joel had talked a little bit about you during the Brownsville revival, I was warned against it. I was told never to go near it. I watched it, and it set my heart on fire. So just wanted to thank you for being used by God.
Yeah, the Lord is good. Awesome. And, you know, that's one of the great hallmarks of a true revival, that Jesus is exalted, that lives are radically changed,
Amen.
And that others reject it. In fact, Arthur Wallace, in his book, In the Day of Thy Power, said something that Duncan Campbell, of fame for the Hebrides revival from 1949 to 1952, Duncan Campbell seconded this, but he said, if it claims to be a revival and it's not spoken against, check again to be sure it's a revival. So,
Amen.
And I've said for years, you can have controversy without revival, but you can't have revival without controversy.
That's
yeah.
Right. Amen. Now, my question is, as people who hold to a non-Calvinistic view, so we would hold to a non-Calvinistic view, and we would, correct me if I'm wrong, but at least I believe that a person can ultimately fall from grace if mm-hmm. they turn from the Lord. So I guess my question is this, Michael. Is it one sin? Is it two sins? Is it a category of sins? Like, when does God finally give up on a person who turns from him?
Yeah, I look at it a little differently than that. So your question is really an appropriate one. Many people can say, this is the moment I was saved. I know it. And then others will say, it was over a period of time God was dealing with me. Here's where I know I made a profession of faith, but he may have been working in my heart before this. So God knows that line, though, right? He knows the moment we pass from death to life. In the same way, God ultimately knows when we cross a certain line. But I don't believe that it's God making the decision as much as us turning away and refusing him. So what's the difference between someone struggling and every day falling short and, God, I feel miserable, forgive me, Lord, I want to serve you, okay? So they don't have the evidence of the overcoming life, but they want to please the Lord and they're struggling deeply. What's the difference between that and someone who says, I reject you, I no longer believe in you, I don't want you in my life, I don't believe you exist, or I'm becoming a Buddhist or whatever. So there is a line, God knows where that line is, where someone forfeits grace, where someone willingly says, I will not follow you. So God knows the difference between someone struggling, and he's merciful, and he's compassionate, and he's loving, and he's kind, and we receive grace every day. And on all of us, even our best day, live by grace, you know, and our very best day, if God was looking for a sin to disqualify us, he could find sin to disqualify us, because we never perfectly love him with all of our heart, soul, mind, strength. And we never perfectly love our neighbors ourselves. That being said, I don't look at it like, oh, I went one step too far, or, oh, I lost my temper three straight days, or I thought this lustful thought four times in an hour. And we live by grace and stand by grace. It's the refusal of that grace, the turning our backs on that grace. So if someone says, I choose sin, I know this is wrong, I know it's sinful, I choose it, and they live out a life in unrepentant disobedience. A Calvinist would say, well, then they were never saved if they die like that. And I respect that view, I just differ with it. In some cases, it may be true. Otherwise, I look at it as someone apostatizing. And this is something that was recognized as a real possibility for centuries in the early church, the possibility of apostasy. There are verses throughout the New Testament that warn, but I want someone, Danny, to feel absolutely secure in God. I am 100% sure of his keeping power, and I rest in that. At the same time, understand sin is deadly and destructive, and you don't play games with it. If you open the door to it today, playing games with it today, and don't shut that door, that thing that you're playing with today may be dominating you tomorrow. All right. I hope that is helpful. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Brian in Ports. All right. We're going to go to Brian. Actually, it was a related question, but I guess Brian couldn't hold. Let's go to Sean in. And Sean couldn't hold. Friends, that means a couple of phone lines have just opened up, which is like a treasure here on a Friday. So go for it. Great time to call, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Iowa. Josh, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. Before I get to my question, I just want to say I love you, and I've been blessed by your ministry time and time again.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. So my question's a little loaded, so I'm going to try to answer it in the quickest and most concise way I can.
Sure.
So basically, there's lots of old or new early Christian writing in the first and second century. And so I guess my question is, obviously we don't hold those as authoritative. They don't hold a candlestick to the Bible. But I'm wondering if we see consensus amongst the early Christians, and then we also see it in the Bible, like it could be interpreted that way. And it's opposite, like it's not the same as our theology. Could it be possible that I'm not holding the apostolic faith, the faith once and all handed down to the saints, like in Jude 3?
Okay, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question. Are you saying that if there are writings from early church leaders that you differ with today, that you are not in harmony with, but as far as you're concerned,
yeah,
you believe what's in the Bible, but these early writings seem to say something different, perhaps they're right and you're misinterpreting the Bible? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, like let's say I was a Calvinist, but
yeah,
and I...
You can't find support for Calvinism for several centuries until Augustine.
Yeah.
So are you getting it right? Okay, so here, it's a wonderful question. I just want to make sure I rightly understood it.
Yeah.
Catholics would argue that the church traditions support them. The Orthodox, Greek and Russian Orthodox, would argue that the church traditions support them.
Mm-hmm.
Others would say, well, see, that's what the church got wrong, you know, and Augustine recovered things. Or I would say that you take very seriously what the disciples of the apostles had to say, right?
Right.
You take very seriously, for example, Polycarp being a disciple of the apostle John. You take very seriously what they had to say because they were much closer than we are. On the other hand, we also recognize that they would be the first to say what's written in Scripture is what's written, and that our writings do not have the authority of the writings of the apostles. And even the pseudo-gospels, the different gospels that were written, none of them had any widespread recognition among the early believers except the four canonical gospels. So the idea of, you know, lost gospels and all that's a myth. That's a separate story. However, I would say as a Messianic Jew that some of the things Paul warned about in terms of despising the branches or being arrogant against the branches that were cut off, that starts to happen pretty quickly. To the point that even though we see Jewish believers living the way Paul and Peter and the apostles lived as Jewish believers, that and you see it, you know, up through the time of Jerome and even after, that these were largely misunderstood, that the Jewish believers who held to Orthodox Christology and things like that, they were misunderstood, and I believe that's something Paul warned about. So I'll look at all those things very, very carefully. I'm not a scholar of the church fathers or anything like that. I take it seriously, but ultimately I recognize there are different views, there are different expressions, things work themselves out. Remember, this is a brand new movement, right? And now it's been released into brand new territory with a flood of people coming in. So I'm going to look at them. I'm going to learn from them. I'm going to see where they have an insight that can challenge me. But ultimately, I've got to go back to the consistent testimony of Scripture. Sure thing. And Josh, I just want to see if I can find this. There is an author named David Burcott, if I remember correctly. Yeah, there we go. B-E-R-C-O-T. And he has a number of books about how the early Christians lived. He's got a book Will the Real Heretics Please Stand Up? A New Look at Today's Evangelical Church in the Light of Early Christianity. Ah, that sounds interesting. And then he has Dictionary of Early Christian Beliefs. So it's David Bercot, B-E-R-C-O-T. I would highly recommend getting that because he breaks things down systematically and you get your different subjects, right? Will the Real Heretics Please Stand Up? One book, the other, a Dictionary of Early Christian Beliefs. So he breaks them down point by point by point. So you can see, all right, we don't have much here. Or, wow, we got like 30 quotes and they all seem to see things and do things the same way. So by all means, check that out. I think you'll find it helpful. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Chase in Lusby, Maryland. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you for taking my call today.
You bet.
All right. Just a really quick note. I just want to say thank you for your ministry and thank you for that the Lord has used you in my life to grow in the spiritual maturity and in my relationship with the Lord.
Well, thank you, Chase. That means the world to me. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. I just wanted to ask you two specific questions. What is your personal view about Christian contemplation, you know, like having supernatural experiences with the Lord through visions or dreams or hearing the voice of God? Mm-hmm. Because just throughout like last year, while I was trying to look into the supernatural gifts and the spiritual practices in Christianity, like contemplation, I would hear like hypercritical websites that would try to criticize the practice of contemplation just through bad experiences, but yes, they missed the full picture. And then just like later this year, I would hear the writings of A.W. Tozer and William James Seymour on how they practice it. So how do you distinguish between, so how do you distinguish how it's widely used?
Yeah, so let me, I'm just jumping in because we've got a break here. Yeah, very simple, just like 1 Corinthians, the Corinthians were excelling in the gifts, and Paul commended them for that, but they had other issues, and they abused the gifts in some ways. That's going to happen. So what you want to do is look at the scriptural model. Absolutely, God speaks through dreams, visions, and his sheep, Jesus' sheep, hear his voice. Absolutely. I'd encourage you to get a book, classic book now, by Jack Deere, Surprised by the Voice of God. Surprised by the Voice of God. By Jack Deere. Tells a great story and encourages you. Hey, Acts 2, this continues in the last days. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for being part of our broadcast. If you think of me this week, Sunday afternoon, scheduled to leave for India, get back the following Sunday. Yeah, so it's a long trip. I think I spend more time traveling than actually over there, but we've got 3.5 wonderful days to be in India. So please pray for grace on the trip and for anointing. We've got some wonderful broadcasts scheduled for you all next week, all brand new, that will bless you and stir you and help you. And, if you can help us with a one-time gift, year-end tax-deductible contribution, that would really bring encouragement. And don't think, oh, I can only give this much. Don't worry about that. Everybody doing their part. Number one, God sees based on what we have, not on what we don't have. And two, it just means the world that you're standing with us and we're hearing from you. So go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, click on donate. All right, so Chase, very quickly, in Acts, the second chapter, when Peter talks about the outpouring as they're hearing the new languages being spoken, and he says that this is that which Joel spoke about, and it talks about prophecy being poured out. Your sons and daughters shall prophesy, your young men shall see visions, your old men shall dream dreams. He says this is going to be the last days. The last days is from Jesus dying and rising until the end of the age. So this is absolutely something God is doing on a regular basis. Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Miracles, documents some amazing ministry to Muslims where God is working with dreams and visions. The thing is, though, we don't seek an experience, we seek God. We don't seek a voice, we seek God's truth. And then as he speaks to us and leads us, moves us, stirs us, gives us dreams, visions, then we learn to recognize how he communicates with us and we grow through it. As long as we major on loving Jesus, living godly lives, reaching the lost, being people of the word, and we're grounded in those things, these are all wonderful ways in which God communes with us. All right, your second question, sir.
Yes. The second question is about dealing with the concerning about profanity in vulgarity languages.
Yeah.
For ever since Jesus radically changed my life, of course, he cleansed out all the vulgarity, all the profanity that I used to do many, like a few years ago. But
yeah.
My struggle is that even though I got some family like unsafe family members that would use that, and I would try to not get involved like in the profanity jokes or not try to somehow get along with it, but yet I don't want to necessarily try to isolate myself in an
yeah.
extreme way. So how should we as believers, or can you just give me good advice on how to
yeah,
deal with
sure.
this?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we're in the world, we're not of it, and we're yeah. going to be around junk. Some things defile us more than others. For example, if I was an alcoholic and then God saved me and then I got free from alcohol, I'd just stay away from bars. And if there were family gatherings where everyone was getting drunk, I'd be in another room or I wouldn't be there. On the other hand, if all my family members are atheists and they're God mockers and I just got saved, like what a great opportunity to be around them and share the gospel. And if it's not time to share the gospel, then they're going to be blasting this and blasting this, oh, whatever, you know, that's the way it is. So I, you know, worked for years in different secular professions before going into, quote, full-time ministry. So you're often around profane people. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, to separate from them, you'd have to leave the world entirely. So there may be something that is just defiling the person, is so vulgar, it's constant sex jokes, and it's, you know, a family member, relative, you might have to say, hey, listen, I'm not telling you how to live, but I don't find this stuff funny anymore. Just got to be honest with you. But otherwise, I want to do my best to be around people that don't know the Lord, that are going to have all their rough edges so that I can bring the gospel to them. However, if who they are and what they do actually on a regular basis drags me down, then I have to have some space. So that's what you have to evaluate. Can you pray, spend great time with the Lord and go into that environment and shine light? And if they crack their joke, you just kind of like, you know, in the early days, I probably would have been like, I'm too holy for that joke. I'm not, you know, now if I heard some just off color joke, I'd be like, you know, I might grin at them and say, not really my style. In other words, I don't want to seem so uptight that they associate that with just being religious and you're so uptight. It's like, yeah, I know it's funny. It's not really my style. And just be kind of low key about it. And sometimes that's the best way. When I worked one job when I was 18 years old in a summer job before going to college, and it was like 7 a.m. till 3:30 in the afternoon. I got this early shift, so I go to church services every night. And we're working on this beach, cleaning things, and all the guys were just worldly, mocking me and profane and all this. And I was one of the youngest, and some were probably up to their mid-20s. But I asked them, could you just stop using profanity? And they agreed for a little while. And then they said, "That we're under enough pressure already. And I realized, yeah, that really wasn't up to me to try to enforce a code of speech. But I was brand new and witnessing all the time and the stuff came up. So I'd be low-key about it unless it's really defiling. Then I'd separate. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Josh in Los Angeles. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Michael Brown. How you doing today?
Doing very well. Thank you.
All right, great. Yeah, you're like one of my favorite teachers next to Derek Prince. I really appreciate your ministry.
Well, thank you.
I just have a question or two. I'm struggling with like obesity. Like I'm over like probably 320 pounds or more, and I've been trying to lose weight and going on these streaks where I'll go down to like 260, 280, or 250, and then I'll come back up. And I've had about three different episodes where I've done good and then just fell back into it. And I got your book, Breaking the Stronghold of Food. I'm not done with it. I just started it, but I like what you have to say in there. But I'm just I just have a question. Like, how did you, like, overcome, like, I know it's so easy to just say, oh, yeah, God gave me the power, but we still have a choice to deny our flesh. But how did you overcome and actually be consistent even to, how many years has it been since you've been, you're at your ideal weight now?
4.25 years now.
Congratulations. Yeah, so, see, I know I need to do that, and I just want to know
hard.
How did you.
Yeah, Josh, it's okay, for me, it's a lifestyle. For me, it's easy now, going to India, traveling, you know, taking certain foods with me, taking things to eat on the plane, having the folks make sure they have salads for me there, sitting around with Thanksgiving as everybody's feasting. You know, I was the only one, right where everyone I was sitting with, you know, that was, you know, we had a lot of people there, but surrounded by people feasting and eating all kinds of things. And it was not a problem whatsoever. You know, I had some turkey because I have a little grilled meat once a week, but it was easy. No problem, but I recognize that it's by God's grace, and there were some very definite steps that I had to take. So first thing, Josh, is I cried out to God on and off for years. And I got up to maybe 275 pounds, being just about 6'3". I could get away with it a little bit, you know, like a big football player, but I was obese and it was unhealthy and I had high blood pressure and I didn't like it. And Nancy had been praying for years, crying out as well. So God heard our cry. That's the first thing I can say, is we both really cried out and we kept crying out. First thing. Second thing is, put all your excuses on the table. Just tell God, I can't do it. I don't know how. I've tried like 30 times and I don't know how. You know, be honest, all right? Then next thing is, we really need to understand why you overeat. Now, part of it's food addictions, you know? That's obvious. We're addicted to certain foods. But once we break those addictions, why is it that we go back to the wrong eating? Some people eat for comfort. Some people eat because they're bored. Some people eat. For me, food was my reward. Food was my built-in reward that, okay, I'm going to India. I'm going to be traveling 30, 40 hours. I eat what I want on the plane, you know, and then have a special meal at this hotel and pig out there, you know, the night before I fly back. And then, you know, I preach all day, all night in the States, get back to my hotel room. Of course you eat, you know, get to the hotel and there's a, you know, fresh baked cookie. Wait, well, that's a gift from God. So I realized that food was a built-in reward. And I get into this in the book. It was a built-in reward for me. And I had to reprogram my mind. So in the early weeks, God's grace kicked in, but I had some struggles. Nancy encouraged me every day, sent me testimonies, sent me quotes every day. And then once I realized that God had helped me, I realized, you can't play with this. You can't play with this. It's life and death. I did something where I tested my biological age the other day, got some tests done and then ran through all these questions. And it put me at like 55, whereas I'm 63 and a half right now. So I thought, and I feel much younger than that as well. And I can out-exercise and outwork people a third my age. So I know it has been absolutely life-changing. But Josh, I want to say two things. Keep reading the book and don't quit. Don't stop. I don't care how many times you get discouraged and hit bottom. Also, we're going to get your name and address right now. I want to send you a CD series that I did where I'm going to coach you as well. So I want to send you the CD series where I coach you. So as soon as we're done, our call screener is going to get on the line with you and get your address. And then we have a Facebook page called We're Breaking the Stronghold of Food. Don't go to Breaking the Stronghold of Food. That's inactive. Go to We're Breaking the Stronghold of Food, and you can share your needs. Say, I'm struggling. Can you pray? You'll get people encouraging you going back and forth there at We're Breaking the Stronghold of Food. But Josh, stay right there. We're going to get your name and address. I want to mail you those CDs where I'm going to coach you and help you and encourage you. The same God who helped me, my friend, will help you. All right. Be blessed. Sorry I couldn't get you more of your calls. We got to as many as we could. God bless you. Please do pray for me on this India trip.